Thanks, Brother Jim. And yeah, the little handout that's coming out we'll refer to later, so there's no urgency to get to it. What I wanted to do was just give you something that would maybe help you remember some of the things we're going to talk about, and just to sort of take away. And we'll make reference to it throughout the week. The other thing I want to draw your attention to right at the beginning is we've got a nice orange box up here, which is a question box. If you have any questions or comments, or perhaps some answers, feel free to just put them in there. I'll check it at the end of the day, and we might try and work that into the you know, the classes the next day. So a little bit of background. We okay? Uh-oh. All right, well, he's filling out. I'll give you the little background. About 6 years or so ago, I did a study on Josiah. My oldest son is named Josiah. We always liked the name Josiah. And I did a study on that for kids camp at Manitoulin. And we had a great week together looking at the life of Josiah. And what grew out of that was Josiah's handling of idols. And our sixth class will actually be on Josiah particularly. So from that, I think it's going to work now. Oh, good. Sorry about that. Technology works great, except when it doesn't work. All right. So, and we'll leave some extras of these in case no one got them. But that's just a little reminder of some of the things we're going to be looking at. So we've been looking at Josiah and been impressed by his handling of idols. And that put into our mind this, you know, handling or dealing with idolatry. And it's like anything in Scripture. Once you have your mind set on something and you're thinking about a particular thing, it doesn't matter where, you know, the daily readings, doesn't matter where you go, you just see it over and over and over again. And it kind of developed in then to an entire study on its own. And so that's kind of where this came from. So idol worship in the 21st century, and in particular, as Brother Jim noted in his announcement of the title, today's class sounds almost the same, except it's in the 21st century BC. It's been going on for a while. That's kind of our point. So what we hope to do this morning is sort of take a broad sweep of some of the history of God's people and how they struggled with idolatry. Now, just before we do that, one of the things we want to start off is, you know, why we're talking about idolatry. And it's interesting, some of the response, and I appreciate people coming up and talking to me about things, and up to this point, it's been an anticipation of what there might be based on the topics, the titles. And it's been great because all of you have said, you know, we're really interested in what you're going to say, and it's time for us to talk about these things. But some people might look at it and say, what are we talking about bowing down to little stone gods for? Like, you know, it's not an issue. But it is relevant for today, and we've looked at this a couple of times, and it's one of the works of the flesh. Okay, so you got to get your head around the fact that somehow we got to come to terms with this. So there in Galatians chapter 5, it says, now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and the such like, of which I tell you before, as I have also told you in time past. So Paul's repeated this several times, and we looked at another one earlier in Corinthians in our introduction on Saturday night, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, I want you to start looking for this, and in your readings groups, there's at least a couple of things in today's readings. In Jeremiah, obviously, it's right in the time of the kings, and in particular Josiah. And also in the Matthew reading, I found a couple, and I won't say what I found, but try and do that in your groups, okay? Where's idolatry in this? And you're just going to see it everywhere, and it's something that's very, very relevant. Now, by way of introduction, that's my house. Disclaimer is, it's actually a two-family home. I live with my parents. They live in this part, and my family and I live in this part over here. Now, you might have a couple of reactions to seeing that picture. You know, in the passage, we're going to look at Timothy a couple of times about, you know, being content and, you know, all we need is food and raiment. And some people might say that's a little bit more than food and raiment. There's a couple of reactions you might have. You might say, wow, nice house. Or you might say, wow, what a lot of work. okay? And it sort of depends on, you know, how long you've lived there. A couple of things, I don't know if you notice right there, and just, I was thinking about it when I took the picture, but that's a ladder, because I'm trying to repair the siding on the house, which I still haven't really accomplished very well. And Faith was up there earlier this summer painting windows, and, you know, it's a lot of work. There's a ton of grass to cut. We have a lot of comforts in this life, especially in the Western world. I show you that picture, and I hesitated to whether to include the slide or not, because at the end of this week, you're either going to think that I'm one of the biggest hypocrites that's ever walked the face of the earth, or that I'm just like you, struggling with how we live in Western world in the 21st century, dealing with all the stuff we have thrown at us, all the potential there is for an easy life, and the push from society to make it right. You're kind of you're graded on how what kind of car you drive, what kind of house you live in, or what kind of job you have. That's how you're measured. And to put that to one side is difficult and challenging. So I hope that you'll see that I'm actually a brother struggling with living in 21st century North America and sharing with you experiences, and so we can help each other survive this age, because that's what it's going to come down to. Because remember our previous verse, idolatry will exclude us from God's kingdom. And I know what I'm going to try to show you this morning is that idolatry is very much a part of our life. All right, but we're going back, first of all, to the very beginning. So the idol worship in the 21st century B.C. You realize that it's the first commandment. In fact, it's the first and the second. If you want to go to Exodus chapter 20, you know, most of the stuff we will have is on the slides, but you'll want to follow along. We want to have our Bibles open. I don't know if you've ever taken the time to go through and, you know, find the Ten Commandments, because they're sort of spread out throughout Exodus chapter 20. But here we have in verse 3 and 4 is actually the first two commandments. The first one is, thou shalt have no other god before me, in verse 3. And then most feel the second one is in verse 4. It kind of sounds like the same. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children of the third and fourth generation, and so on. And verse 7 is the third one, right? Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And the next one's in verse 8, remember the Sabbath day, and so on. And so they go. So the first two commandments cover a number of verses there, and it's essentially, don't make idols, don't make images. Now, there's a similar verse here in Leviticus 26. You shall make no idols nor graven image, neither rear up a standing image, neither shall you set up any image of stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. Now, there's a word that's screaming out to you that's an echo. So what words do you see there in those passages that are just kind of like being repeated over and over and over again? Someone, go ahead. What's image? And when we think of image, and an associated word there is likeness, what comes to our mind? Image and likeness, right? Where's our minds right now? Genesis, right? Genesis chapter 1, was it verse 26? The Lord God made man and formed him in his image and his likeness. So there's a connection there. See, it's right at the very, you know, the fabric of how we were created. We're created in God's image and likeness. So we're not to make images or likenesses ourselves of other things, because it's an offense to God. We are made in God's image. He doesn't want us to try and make images and likenesses. It's something that sort of replaces God. He's like, what, aren't you good enough? Isn't what I did good enough that you've got to do something else? And so anything that sort of replaces what God's done in our lives or for us, then is this image or this idol. And it's an oft-repeated command. I mean, we have just shown you a couple there. It's over and over and over again. It's kind of important. All right, we know from our good Bible reading techniques that when something's repeated this much, God's trying to get our attention. Now, interestingly enough, it's there in verse 17 of chapter 20, and I've sort of got a summary of the Ten Commandments there, you know, broken down perhaps as some people see them, ones that relate to God and ones that relate to man. But the last one is, thou shalt not covet. Now, if you remember, if you were there on Saturday night, we did a little introduction, what's the connection? Idolatry and covetousness, what's the connection? Covetousness is idolatry. And I think we looked in Colossians, we might have turned it up, you make a note of it, Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, that covetousness is idolatry. So not only the first two commandments, don't make images, don't make idols, don't bow down to them, the last one is the same, don't covet. Don't covet anything. Look at the big long list there. And covetousness is idolatry. So of the Ten Commandments, 30% of them cover this topic. All right, it's kind of important. All right, that's the message we're trying to get across. Now, I have a thesis or a premise that I'm going to hopefully prove to you, and that is that idolatry has always been a problem for the people of God. Right, and I mean that. All right, and what we're doing now, we're going looking back to, you know, 22 millennia before Christ. We're going to go right back to Genesis chapter 35 and just have a look at this. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods that were in their hand. That's bizarre. Like, you know, there's no indication. You know, there's the Rachel with the teraphim thing and, you know, what they were. And there's some stuff going on, but it's not a big issue, it doesn't seem. And all of a sudden, wham, there it is. Jacob's saying, you know, look, we've got to get our act together here, okay? And we're going up to Bethel, and what's Bethel? The house of God. So we got to go up to the house of God. We can't go there with these strange gods. And by the way, you might think, yeah, strange gods, they looked kind of peculiar. We'll look at some pictures in a minute. That's not what it means. It's not strange in that sense. It's the gods of strangers. They're foreign gods, okay? They're the gods that somehow they've accumulated. They've come into the camp. And Jacob's like, enough is enough, okay? We've got to get rid of these things. We're going to God's house, okay? Way back in Genesis 35, all right? The people of God trying to, you know, the ecclesia in its infancy, right? The patriarchs, the family of God. And, you know, the lesson is we have to get rid of idols, brothers and sisters, before we go to God's house, okay? It's as simple as that. And they get to the promised land, and I'm skipping over. If we looked at every single one, we wouldn't have enough time. Okay, so we've now moved into the promised land, and they've conquered the land, and this is Joshua 24, so this is towards the end. And this is Joshua, you know, in his sort of final appeal to the people, all right? Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, all right? Wow, that's a phrase that has a lot of meaning for us as Christadelphians, doesn't it? It makes us think of Christ's words. Put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the flood, and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. So he's going way back. He's going, look, Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees. He had to leave all those gods behind, and somehow traces of them have remained. Then we were down in Egypt, and we know what happened there, and when they came out of Egypt, and he's saying, look, it's dogged us. It's dogged our steps from our very infancy, from our father Abraham, Moses in Egypt. We've got to put away these things. And now here we are in the promised land, he says. Get rid of them. There's this stuff still hanging on, this baggage. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you'll serve. You got to make a decision, he says. You know, it's kind of like time is up. We've got to do it. Whether you will serve the gods which your father served that were the other side of the flood, so he's going way back to Abraham's time, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. Okay, so he's saying, like, we're here now in the promised land, and they're still surrounded by gods. Okay, so the whole sweep of history of Israel up to this point. Who can finish the quote for me? I got dot, dot, dot. Who can finish the quote? Choose you this day whom you're going to serve. Which god are you going to serve? The previous gods, the gods of the land, who are you going to serve? Right, exactly correct. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Now, how many people have that plaque somewhere in their house? Just the last 10 or 12 words there. How many? It's somewhere. It's on a plaque. It's in our. It's a great big painted on the chart on the side of our ecclesial hall. Okay, we've got it somewhere. You know, it's on the doormat before you enter in. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Brothers and sisters, the context of that quote is getting rid of idolatry. You can't have that plaque on your house and have a house full of idols. You can't do it. That's what he's saying. It's impossible. You cannot serve God and mammon. You can't do it. He's saying, look, make a decision. Who are you going to serve? In my house, we're going to have this plaque, Joshua says. We're going to serve the Lord. We're going to get rid of the idols. What are you going to do? That's what Joshua's saying. And I've never realized it before. It's kind of a cute little phrase, right? We're going to serve the Lord, and we're just going to... But our house is full of idols. They're everywhere in our house, if your house is like mine. And yet, you know, we think we can say and we can claim to be serving the Lord. So that was the time of in the promised land and end of Joshua's life. We're moving into the time of the judges. Right? Judges chapter 10, starting at verse 10. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, saying, we have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God and served Balaam. See, those things always go hand in hand. If you're serving God, you're forsaking the Baals, the gods of the land. Or if you're forsaking God, you're serving them. You can't do both. One will displace the other. And the Lord said unto the children of Israel, did not I deliver you from the Egyptians and from the Ammonites, the Zidonians also, and the Amalekites? And you cried unto me, and I delivered you out of their hand. Like, I've proven myself to you before. You've put me to the test. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Wherefore, I will deliver you no more. Go cry to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation. And so you're kind of like, the game's up, he's saying. You know? Like, if you've given yourselves over to these gods, well, ask them for help to see how you do. And I got thinking about that. And, you know, I guess we have to ask ourselves, in what do we trust for deliverance? You know, when the going gets tough, where do we turn? Because I believe what this is saying to us, brothers and sisters, is that God will use our false gods to put us to the test. He almost has to. He has to give us over to these things so that we can learn to truly trust in him. It's almost an axiom of how God deals. He's not going to force us. He's not going to rip the gods away from us. We have to come to that conclusion. So in what do we put our trust for deliverance? And I'm going to be trying to make this very practical throughout the week. And I'm sorry if I hit a particular thing for you. And if I don't hit something that you know, because I'm not aware of what's in your life, I'm hoping you're making those conclusions for yourself. All right? And I don't mean any offense by it. All I can really draw on my own experience and having talked to people. So if I seem to be hitting the same thing over and over again and it's you and you're like, he's hitting me again, I'm sorry about that. But more importantly, if I kind of don't mention something that you know is a problem for you, don't think, oh, Chris didn't mention it, so it must be okay. It's just maybe I'm not aware of it. All right? So in what do you put your trust for deliverance? Your bank account? You know, when going gets tough, no problem. We'll just get more money. That'll solve the problem. Money always solves a problem. Perhaps insurance, right? It's a great North American or Western world kind of invention, right? Doesn't matter if the house burns down. They're just going to be rebuilt. It's no problem. It's no big deal, okay? Institutions of man. You know, we have, like, the social welfare and all that kind of stuff. It's fantastic what we have in the Western world. And I'm not trying to malign that, but if we get to the point, and this one hits home a little closely to home, because like in the ecclesial world, you know, we don't have to look after brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so who gets into, you know, loses the job or whatever, because, well, the government will take care, right? They'll get unemployment insurance or whatever. And it's only when either for whatever reason those sorts of things don't work out that we're like, oh, just a sec, you mean we have to help them out? What's with that, you know? That we rely on the institutions of men to take care of problems that in the past would have brought a community closer together. And I think we're lesser for it in the long run. Anyway, that's the judges. I think there's one more bit there. So what did they do? They put away the strange gods from among them and served the Lord, and his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel. They reacted. And I know when the judges, it's up and down, but I mean, that's my life. And I'm sure it's yours as well. You know, we have peaks and valleys. We kind of make a resolution to do some things, and God is grieved for the misery of his people. He's like, I know how hard it is, a struggle that you're going through, but please trust me. trust me and rely upon me, not on these other things, you know, that you've imagined, these strange gods, gods of the strangers, the foreign gods, the world out there, what they set up as their god. So that was the Judges. It's just taken from a kid's Bible, obviously, an illustrated Bible. But again, just capture here. This is now the time of Samuel. It's 1 Samuel 7. If ye do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, right, and Brother Jay was talking about that in the first class, you know, giving God all, that's what it's about, because there's this struggle going on, this battle. So this is Samuel's appeal. It's like, have we heard this before? Jacob said, we're going to Bethel, put away your gods. You know, Joshua had to say, make a decision, who are you going to serve? And here's Samuel. Then put away the strange gods and the Ashtoreth that are from among you. Prepare your hearts unto the Lord and serve him only. Then the children of Israel did put away the Baalim and the Ashtoreth and served the Lord only. It's like, okay, how many times the same pattern? Now, again, my premise or my thesis was that idolatry has always been a problem for the people of God. So we've now just covered many years of history from Jacob now through to Samuel. All right, do you think it stopped there? Okay, do you think this message is irrelevant for us today? I don't think so. I think what we're being told in Scripture is idolatry is always a problem for God's people. And perhaps we've kind of tried to ignore it and sort of pussyfoot around it because, well, we don't have little images and idols in the corner of our house, you know, made out of stone and wood and so on. All right, in that sort of traditional view. Like, for example, you know, some of these ones, we're going to look at them. But the challenge is to believe that, no, it is still an issue for us. So two were mentioned there, Ashtoreth and Baal. We're just going to quickly take a little look at that. Judges chapter 10, verse 6, the children of Israel did evil against again in the sight of the Lord and served Baalim and Ashtoreth and the gods of Syria and the gods of Zidon and the gods of Moab and the gods of the children of Ammon and the gods of the Philistines and forsook the Lord and served not him. That always happens. One displaces the other. Always. We try to pretend it's not that way. Well, it's different for us. It's not going to happen to me, right? Okay, that's the way. But anyway, there's Ashtaroth, also known as Ishtar or Astari, Astar. Oh, that was kind of interesting. I mean, the language even is, it just makes you shake your head. I mean, she was a star. Ashtaroth was a star, okay? Later on in the Greek, as they kind of passed it along, she became Aphrodite. I couldn't get any pictures of her that would be appropriate to show on the screen. So you get the idea. You know, it's pretty crude and it's graven in stone. You get the picture, right? What this was all about. Okay, the moon goddess of the Phoenicians, the principal female deity, Baal being her male counterpart. All right, and we're going to look at this throughout the week. The association with idolatry was always immorality. And kind of just living the good life. That's what it was about. And it wasn't so much bowing down to that funny-looking idol there. That was really not what it's all about. It was much bigger than that, and we'll deal with that as we go through. When we look at Baal, the word Baal literally means Lord. It's pretty simple. The name appropriated to the principal male god of the Phoenicians, it is found several places in as Baalim, plural, the lords. The sun god, under the general title of Baal, or Lord, was the chief object of worship of the Canaanites. And each locality had its own special little Baal. That was kind of neat. Like, you know, as you went to places, they kind of, well, what's your Lord? What's your Lord? You know, and so we ask ourselves, well, what's Lord of your life? What's Lord of your life? You know, there can be only one Lord, okay? But these try and creep in. The attractiveness of this worship to the Jews undoubtedly grew out of its licentious character. As we said, there was no doubt what Ashtaroth and Baal were on about. You know, that's why they were in groves, on high places, secluded places. You know, what was going on then is no different at one level from what's going on in our world today. We probably have more access to it and the lifestyle that they offered. Now, just a quick little aside, as I was preparing this, I'm thinking, okay, it's one thing to look at that, you know, that sculpture, carved out of stone and so on, and think, well, we don't have those. Well, in some ways we do, and I just, as a quick little aside, and I hope we won't pay for this later, Baal and Ashtaroth are actually still around. That's St. Peter's Square, whatever, in Rome, the Vatican there. This eight-wheeled spoked wheel is literally from Ishtar, Ashtaroth. And there's an obelisk in the center of the square of the Vatican, at the Vatican there. The obelisk at the center of the wheel is a genuine Egyptian obelisk shipped from Hierapolis to Rome by the Roman Emperor Caligula. The obelisk is, of course, a phallic symbol, but is also used in sun worship. So, I mean, it is kind of interesting that literally in our world today, for those who have eyes to see, we literally still have Ashtoreth and Baal. They're right there. If you go in a little bit closer and zoom in, we've now zoomed in on that obelisk. And what we have here, so there's the big wheel on the outside, and there's another littler one in the middle here. It says, in this photo at the center of St. Peter's Square, note the that around the obelisk at the center of the huge eight-point sun wheel is a smaller four-point sun wheel. The same symbol is found on the altar stone in the Temple of Baal in Hatzor, Israel. And that's it up there. So that's, you know, they've dug that up in Hatzor, Israel. Archaeologists have, and I mean, it's identical to there. So right at the center of the Roman Catholic, you know, most holy place there, as it were, is idolatry, literally Ashtaroth and Baal. And of course, all you have to do is go into many churches today and you see lots of examples of literal idols. They're bowing down, they're kissing them, and so on. So in some ways you think like, okay, and like 4,000 years later, like we're still doing the same thing. Okay, some people are. But I don't want to make that sort of the main lesson, because, you know, we could simply say, well, we don't do that. You know, you go into any Christadelphian ecclesia and, you know, we don't have images of dead saints or Mary or whatever, you know, so we must be okay because we're not doing that. So that was the purpose of that quick little aside, to say we can't laugh too much at the ancients, you know, that literally had these graven stone figures, because they still are around today. But now we want to sort of say, okay, well, what's it for us? All right, one more Old Testament god, Molech. He's got some other names, Milcon, Melcom, Chemosh. Okay, literally he means king. So Baal's lord, and Molech is king. All right, what's lord of your life? What reigns in your life? Okay, now that sort of broadens things out a little bit more, because what does Paul say we shouldn't let reign in our life? Let not sin, therefore, reign in your body. Okay, so, and now that's starting to maybe hit a little closer to home. Okay, because we can have king sin in any kind of number of manifestations. But again, here it is. The name of the national god of the Ammonites, to whom children were sacrificed by fire. He was the consuming and destroying, and also became at the same time purifying fire. And brothers and sisters, this is where, again, maybe make you get a little bit uncomfortable. Because you can see that in some ways, Israel might have been attracted to this, right? Our God's a consuming fire, fire purifies, you know, let's make the supreme sacrifice. In some warped, twisted way, it kind of sounds right. I mean, what greater thing could you do to your God than give your child? Now, we cringe at that, don't we? And the picture here is an artist's rendition of what it might have looked like. It's actually not that big. The one at the very beginning of the session is his arms come together like this, and a baby fits right in there. Okay, so they'd kindle the fire in here, and swing the arms down, and the baby would lie right in there. So it's quite a short statue, and it's, you know, it's about this big. It's just sort of almost life size. Cradles the baby, and it gets burned. Now, whether let it get burned to death or just scarred, like burned, that is, there's some debate over that. And we're going to talk about Molech a little bit later, this is a bit of an introductory thing, so we make reference to, you know, Baal or Ashtaroth or Molech. Hopefully you have something to draw on. But I mean, you just have to ask yourselves, do we sacrifice our kids to anything? Now, to us, it's not a literal fire god like that we see the child either die or become, you know, maimed for life. But if we really thought about it, you know, have we pushed our kids into things, whether it's, and I'll draw a lot of analogies from sport, because that's a real problem for me personally. You know, do we, and here's an example. I was talking to one of the sisters in our meeting, and a neighbor, a friend of this sister, said to her, well, I sacrificed church today to take my son to hockey. You know, there was a conflict there, and I had to give up church so we could take my son to hockey. Now, hockey is a big deal where I come from. Interesting, the sister's response to her neighbor, I sacrificed hockey today to take my son to church. You know, so, like, when you really, it might hurt a little bit, and it might not be sport for you, it might be something else, academic endeavor or some other hobby or whatever that we think is great and it's going to make life better for our children in the future. But if we're putting something in place of God in their life when they're 12 or younger, what kind of decision will they make when they're 20 or 30? You know, how are we setting them up? In a sense, have we sacrificed them to one of the gods of this world? Question to ask ourselves. And now we're into the kings. And God has to say in 1 Kings 11, verse 33, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways to do that which is right on my eyes and to keep my statutes and my judgments, as did David, his father. So, from the patriarchs to the kings, brothers and sisters, every single generation struggled with idolatry. And again, I just ask the question, do we think it's any different today? Why should the people of God today be excluded from this struggle? I mean, has human nature changed? Has anything else been different so that now we would expect, oh, we don't face this problem? You know, we're not like the children of Israel in the land, or the patriarchs in the land, or the ecclesia in the wilderness, as it were. And I would suggest to you that we do have the same issues to face today. Now, I want to go through two specific incidents in Israel's history. And Exodus 32, the golden calf, we're familiar with it, and I don't want to go, you know, hopefully don't need to go into too much background or anything. It simply says, they rose up early in the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Now, I'd like you to turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 10. This is the New Testament commentary on that. And we're going there for a couple of reasons. A little bit of background. The golden calf, what was attributed to the golden calf when sort of Aaron made the proclamation, what did they sort of proclaim over the image of the golden calf? Just shout out answers. Bingo. This is the gods that brought you up out of Egypt, okay? They probably actually literally came from Egypt. This was an Egyptian god. And in some ways, they carried that with them, right? In their mind. I mean, we know how they made it. They took all their gold off and boiled it down, and they made this thing, right? Aaron made it very simple. They threw in the gold, and out came this calf, right? Okay? But it was in their mind, must have been in their mind. And some have said, you know, it was easier to get Israel out of Egypt than Egypt out of Israel, right? So it's sort of the same for us, like that our nature, whatever it is, and there it was. These be the gods which brought you up out of Egypt. What was the context? Like, why did they think of doing this? What was going on in the camp that they kind of had this harebrained idea? Moses was up in the mountain and they were waiting for his return and they couldn't wait any longer. Does that sound maybe familiar? Can we tire of waiting for someone to come back? All right, and get involved in maybe what's more familiar, or in this case, what was more fun. All right, now in 1 Corinthians 10, he's commenting on this. And we see that he's talking about, you know, the wilderness wanderings. They're baptized into Moses in the sea in verse 1 and 2 of 1 Corinthians 10. We're right there, and Paul's saying, look, these things are for you. It's not just interesting history. They're written for a reason. You know, and it wasn't just the first century ecclesia. It must be relevant to us. They had the same spiritual meat in verse 3. They drank of the same spiritual drink in verse 4. These are baptized believers. These are you and I, been baptized, sharing the bread, sharing the water of the word, okay? But many of them God was not well pleased with, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Verse 5, that's an understatement. Many of them, how about all of them that were 20 years old and over when they came out of Egypt? Now these things were for our example, verse 6, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. It's for our example. That's what he's saying. And now what does he say? He's talking about this incident right here. He says, neither be idolaters as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That's really interesting. He says, don't be idolaters. Because in quotes from Exodus, you know, they made a golden calf. Doesn't say that. Doesn't mention the golden calf at all. What does it mention? They were eating and drinking and playing. It says, when it says Moses came down from the mountains, that some of the people were naked. We don't have to guess at what was going on, all right? That was the power of the idol. It was a lifestyle that was associated with that idol. I mean, they weren't stupid enough, really, I don't think, to just look at that and say, you know, that delivered us. I mean, they had just made it. But somehow in their head, they'd got this, you know, they put that their logic to one side and said, no, this is going to be fun. Okay, we get to do what we really want to do. And it goes on to talk about some other incidents. The next one is about committing fornication. We're going to look very briefly at that one in the next slide and then the whole class tomorrow. Don't tempt them as they tempted Christ in verse 9. We're destroyed of serpents. Don't murmur. So that idolatry, this was sort of the first one. It opened a bit of a floodgate. Idolatry, immorality, murmuring, okay? It's a whole lifestyle that's taking you in an opposite direction from where we want to go. Verse 11, now all these things happen to them as an example, and they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. And it talks about escaping from temptation. All right, God will tempt you. You're going to be tempted. Remember, that's what the judges are. Are you going to trust these things? I'm going to put you to the test. How are you doing having your God look after you? How's that working for you? Okay, so there will be temptation, but there's a way of escape. And I think verse 14 there we have quoted on your handout there, verse 14, wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. That's a message that echoes down through time, and that's why we put it there on your handout, flee from idolatry. Now, the Baal Peor, we're going to come to tomorrow, so I'm just going to very quickly go through that. We're going to spend an entire class tomorrow looking at the reaction of Phinehas to the moral corruption in Numbers 25 there. Baal Peor, Lord of the Opening. It was an opening. And the children of Israel went through that opening and got caught up in all kinds of problems. So there is spiritual corruption, obviously, some false doctrine and false worship. There's some literal corruption, humanism and immorality. And that's basically what we're going to touch on for the rest of the week. Now, for the sake of time, we'll just go through these fairly quickly, but make a note of them. Exodus 23, there's these five don'ts of idolatry. If you look at Exodus 23, in verse 13 it says, don't even mention the God's name. Now you think about that, and I've suggested here that by mentioning the name, in some way you sort of legitimize it and normalize it, like we just kind of talk about these things. And I think we really need to be careful of the language we use. What are we passing on to the next generation by the language we use? He says, don't even mention their name. Don't bow down to them. You're putting them higher than you. You're worshiping, submitting, giving respect. Don't serve them. Okay, service. Who are you going to serve? You can only have one master. Don't do after their works of the flesh, and don't make a covenant. And I think sometimes we get ourselves into a situation, and I've had this said to me, well, you know, we signed my son up for this program, whatever it was. And, you know, at the time we didn't know that it was going to conflict with Sundays or Friday nights, but, you know, we've made a commitment to this, so we got to kind of follow it through. I don't want my son to learn you can just back out of things. It's been said to me. Okay, so we've got it. We've committed to this team. We're going to play on Sunday because I don't want him to, you know, think that you can just make a promise and then back out of it. I'm like, well, okay. All right, so don't make the promise in the first place. Make it very clear right up front. Like, I'm happy to participate in this organization, whatever it might be, but we don't do Sundays here. We're at church on Sunday. All right, that's the promise or the commitment we need to make. And then when it happens, you're not breaking a covenant. You're saying, look, I told you from the beginning, I can't do this on a Sunday morning. Okay, I got other places to be. Deuteronomy 13. We've got to look this one up. I don't know how I'm going to finish in 3 minutes, but anyway. It's always more stuff than you need. All right, but this one is important because this theme is going to echo throughout our week. Deuteronomy 13. It's the test of the false prophet. If there arise a false prophet among you or a dreamer of dreams. Okay, and he says something, and he comes to pass, he makes some sort of prediction, and it comes to pass. How do you handle that? What do you do? Okay, that's how it starts. And it says, well, if in the process of what they're doing, they say in verse 2 there, let us go and serve other gods, like warning flags, okay, that's the problem. Okay, and it's repeated. You know, verse 6, they say, you know, it might be your mother, your daughter, a close friend, let's go serve other gods. Verse 13, let's go serve other gods. So this is a theme. And what Moses is saying to the people, look, you can't, that's where you draw the line. As soon as it gets to the point where you're serving other gods, we have to act. We have to deal with the challenge. We must act. You can't just kind of let it go. You can't rationalize in another way. Idol worship will destroy us. And the message here in Deuteronomy 13 is you've got to obliterate it. When you're doing things, you know, not even a trace, as it were, of these things. And we're going to see at the end of the week that that's exactly what Josiah does with the idols. But there's some encouragement here in verse 4. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him, keep his commandments, obey his voice, serve him, and cleave to him. That's the antidote, brothers and sisters. Put away the idols, cleave to God, walk after his ways, obey him. Verse 11, hear, fear, do no more these things. That's the solution, the antidote, as it were. Now, we might laugh at a passage like this one, Isaiah 45, you know, the foolishness of idolatry. And I mean, I must admit, you chuckle. You imagine this guy goes out into the bush and he hacks down this log and he carries it in and he cuts it up and he makes a fire of it and so on. And then, oh, I've got a log left over. I'm going to carve an idol and I'm going to worship it. And he puts it in the corner of his. And you're like, what? You just got it out of the bush. You just burnt half of it and you're going to fall down and worship this other half? And we kind of laugh at it. How stupid could they be? But again, hopefully this week we're seeing a reflection back of ourselves saying, what do we do in our lives that's similar to that? And someone with a different perspective might be laughing at some of the decisions we make. This next one is just basically the handout. I contracted a little bit to get it on the page there. But these are common elements of all idols. And at one point during the week, we're going to have a brainstorm and just kind of say, okay, what's idols? And I hope you'll be honest. I'll try and be honest, as I have been, with the struggles I have. It's an association with pleasure and things the flesh loves. That's why it's so popular. That's why it's always been a problem for the people of God. Because being people of God doesn't mean we have a different nature, right? We got the same nature. We just hopefully got a different focus. But the flesh is always pulling. So idolatry is association with pleasure and things the flesh loves. There's the power of suggestion in the images, and we'll go a little exercise quickly in a moment about the power of images. You know, you see that whether it's a crude stone image or something a little more sophisticated, it's not really the image. The image is kind of ridiculous sometimes, but what it is associated with. It's very visual. You know, the lust of the eyes, it distracted people from God and his ways. It diverted people's time, energy, money, and affection from the one true God. So if you've got something in your life that impacts you in any of these areas, time, energy, money, affection, I think you need to just give that some thought. And the last one here I think is really important. The fact that there were many idols. Remember in Israel, in Canaan and Palestine, every city kind of had its own lord or Baal. The fact there are many idols implicitly told the people, it's okay to serve this idol part of the time, like serve the sun god or the harvest god or the moon god, like at appropriate time of the day or your life or whatever, like it's okay. You can serve another idol the part of the time. In fact, we're a tolerant society. We'll even let you serve God once in a while. All right? Now just contrast that to the truth. And Jay quoted it this morning. We have to love the Lord our God with all our heart, all our mind, all our strength. See, God won't tolerate rivals because he knows what's good for us. Okay, it's 100% commitment. There's only one God, not many. And you see how idolatry can sort of break us up and get us distracted and think that, oh, it's okay to kind of take our life and make a pie chart out of it. And I'll save one chunk for God, but I'm going to do some other stuff. I can't see it that way. It's all for God, and we got to work it into that mindset. A couple of slides to go here. Power of symbols. We'll go through them very quickly. Okay, I don't have to say anything. It's a symbol. You know what it is and what it means. Okay, these are symbols, and what do they mean? Okay, and I just did a search on the most popular like trademarks or whatever, and they came up. They spend billions of dollars to come up with these things so that you're attracted to them. A couple of final slides, and that's a little bit hard to see, but we'll go back to this. This is incredible. This is Samuel talking to Saul. And what I'm suggesting you do is idolatry can be self-worship. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, to hearken than the fat of rams, for rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. You know, we say, oh, I'm a stubborn person. Well, you just called yourself an idolater. It's not okay to be stubborn, okay, or to look after number one, okay, to think only of yourself. That's idolatry. Covetousness is idolatry, stuff worship. So there's self-worship and there's stuff worship. And this came from Ephesians 5. So there's at least two or three times where it clearly says that a covetous man who is an idolater has no inheritance in the kingdom of God. One last passage. Turn with me to Matthew 22. And Brother Jim mentioned this in his exhortation on Sunday. He alluded to it. I don't think we turned it up. But as we're wrapping up this first session together on idolatry in the 21st century, it's been a problem from as far back as our Bibles go. And I would suggest to you, as long as we live, we will struggle with this. And in Matthew 22, Jesus is challenged. Master, verse 36, what's the greatest commandment in the law? And he has this wonderful answer. Jesus said to him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first great commandment. The second's like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Two commands, love God with everything and love your neighbor. Brothers and sisters, as we wrap this up, idolatry destroys both those commandments. All right? Because it replaces God in your heart. You cannot love God with everything and treasure up something else, whatever that something may be. If there's a battle going on in your life between something else and God, you're losing out to idolatry. All right, so it breaks commandment number one. And if we're totally going after this stuff, these idols, at some point along the line, we'll ignore our neighbor because we're more important, and we'll hurt somebody else because of what we're going after for ourselves. So idolatry destroys the two things on which all the law and the prophets hang. That's how important it is. And so we commend Paul's words to us all, flee idolatry. Thank you.